sessions last week that some of you were not able to attend. John Yoder laid the groundwork for the presentation he made this morning that related specifically to war. He talked of the politics of Jesus and indicated that the striking test cases of the political reality of the gospel lie especially in money and war, material possessions, and the use of violence. And suggested that the politics of Christ presents a radical alternative to the world's understanding of politics, and that's what we seek to deny. It isn't the kind of politics that we like to hear, and therefore wish to deny it as political. That is, in these two cases, giving your money to the poor and loving your enemies, or however you wish to phrase it, distributing wealth and waging peace. In any case, John takes these views seriously, and then from, I assume, the perspective of a Christian pacifist, this morning presented an interrogative critique of mainline Protestant view of a justifiable war. That is, he posed five questions that raise some serious questions about those who support the just war position. We may have an opportunity in our conversation to get back at that. I myself suggested this morning that we may want to do that. Tonight's topic for conversation, however, seeks to move a bit beyond that with the title Nonviolent Action, an Alternative to War. John will speak for a few minutes, and then we will open the conversation to the rest of you. We welcome your comments as well as your questions, so this can be a genuine conversation. About 10 o'clock, we'll take a recess for a few minutes, and those of you who are hitting the trail at 4 in the morning may wish to depart then, and the rest of you who want to continue the conversation can gather around the fire, and we'll continue for another half hour or however long you wish to remain.
As our philosopher has said, we have a kind of mixed kind of subject matter. I've been asked to move a step farther into one particular topic at the same time that there would be room for debate about things that have gone before. And so we should, no one should feel any inhibition about mixing up the different levels of the subject matter. The narrowest form of the question with which one discusses nonviolent action is with the connection that is already in the title as phrased as an alternative to war or to violence. And this is stated in this sense most narrowly as a counter-challenge to the pacifists who, it is feared, are irresponsible because they don't want to do what it seems needs to be done to ward off some evil, and therefore it would be a big help if they could say they have alternative means to ward off that same evil or to achieve that same good. So that one level on which to think about certain specific strategies and tactics of social action, which avoid violence as part of their decision about how to proceed, is to say that's another way to get the same valid goals for which other people think they need to use violence. And there is something to that. I won't try to lay that all out. That would take a very different kind of exposition and literature, but it at least can be said that there have been times and places where nonviolent tactics and techniques have effectively safeguarded certain values against attack or achieved certain purposes which others would have thought would call for violence. There's a body of anecdotal material. There are in the work of Gandhi and Martin Luther King the stories of long-range planning and institutionalized campaigning for certain purposes. Other lesser figures are no less important when they do it in another kind of culture. Danilo Dolci, for instance, in mafia-managed Sicily, or Cesar Chavez in California, or other less organized or less visible specimens from farther back in history. There is also a developing body of social science theory, including a recent 1,000-page Harvard dissertation, analyzing how it is and in what kind of circumstances and subject to what limitations nonviolent kinds of political action can have what kinds of effects. It can't be claimed that you can do everything with nonviolent action that you can do with bombs, obviously. And it can't be claimed that it always succeeds. Neither does war always succeed. It always fails on one side or the other. So that the amount that can be proven is very modest, but the amount that one can ask to have proven is also very modest, and would call for a kind of social science process that would go well beyond what I'm equipped for. But that is a deceptive way to narrow the issue anyway. Because we have to remember, if anything of the exposition that I tried to do Saturday is fair to the facts, that the ethics of the just war tradition are also committed to minimizing violence, always, to eschewing violence or rejecting violence when it cannot meet the criteria which the theory provides for being restrained and effective and keeping within moral bounds, so that the just war theory is also committed to the use of nonviolent methods in all cases except those where a justifiable war has been certified. So that it isn't the case that the only reason for being interested in nonviolent ways of achieving social goals would be that one is a pacifist trying to prove that one is not irrelevant. Secondly, about another quibble about that way of putting the question, we're dealing here with a clash of systems, that is, with not simply that two parties or more disagree on the answers to a question, but disagree about what the question is. When there is a fundamental difference of style in language or thought or ethics, you don't only differ about the answer, you differ about what the question is. And this is one of those cases, because the pacifist whose understanding of his pacifism flows from the incarnation and from who Jesus was, is not obligated to prove his relevance. How relevant was Jesus? After all, he was defeated. He was crucified. He didn't make it. His movement didn't work. Well, that did work was the result of resurrection and Pentecost, which aren't things that we can manage in our social strategy. So that once we take seriously, and we don't have to, of course, that's why I say it's a different set of systems, but if we once take seriously Jesus' statement, I have chosen not to be a lord, but to be a servant, and you are to do the same, then ultimate calculations of effectiveness in guaranteeing worthwhile social goals cannot be a top criterion of that ethical system. We will still care in subsidiary and derived ways for relative effectiveness, but one does not have to prove an alternate solution to some social problem in order to be clear that at least violence isn't the answer. Still another observation about the limits of that earlier, narrower way of putting the problem is the reminder that violence is much less often efficacious than its advocates seem to trust it to be. Very easily now, in our days, in the discussion of what sometimes is called liberation theology, one says, this is a case of last resort, nothing else will work, only this will work. And by that is usually meant some kind of guerrilla warfare against colonialism or against racism in southern Africa. But the fact that nothing else that's been tried has worked does not prove that this will work. This maybe won't work either. It is the notion that something must work is itself an irrational assumption in a fallen world. And the way we see that the most bluntly is by looking at the peculiar dissonance between the reasoning processes on the two sides when we ask about the place of failure, place of suffering, in the scheme. Martin Luther King was supposed to be the keynote speaker in 1968 at the assembly of the World Council of Churches in Uppsala, and was assassinated just about 3 months earlier. There were quite a number of people very concerned for justice for the Third World. There was a very highly organized youth caucus bringing this issue into all of the sections. And many of these people were very clear that the death of King proved that nonviolent tactics will not work. But they were not at all equally clear that the death of Che Guevara had proven that violent tactics won't work. Now that's an interesting dissonance. King knew he was going to be killed. He talked about it even just a couple of days before his death. So did Gandhi. And to be modest, but still recognize the peril, so did Jesus. When someone who says his death is part of what he expects turns out to be right and is killed, you say he was wrong. It didn't work. When somebody, like Che Guevara, says, we have the key to history, we know the dialectics of social change, we know that the Indians and the peasants of Bolivia are waiting for us to galvanize them into an effective revolution, and that's wrong, some of that doesn't refute his system. Somebody who claims that his analysis is causatively, only mechanistically, although it's a dialectical mechanism, sure to work, is not refuted when it doesn't work. Somebody who expects to be crucified is refuted when he is crucified. Now, somewhere there's a dissonance in the logic here of this debate in the way it seems self-evident to the liberationists, that they've made the case for both the necessity and the promise of violence, so that they don't have to look at their failures. Now to begin affirmations after that quibble with the normal way the question seems to be put for some people. The cases that I've spoken of that we know the most about, that most people know something about, of Gandhi and King, were clearly not pacifists trying to prove they were relevant. They were rather people doing what had to be done in a way that was fitting, that fit their theology, both Gandhi's religious view of man, which had some Christian and some Hindu components, and King's view, which had some Southern Black Baptist and some New England Methodist components. They were doing what was right, what made sense, what fit the circumstances, what also fit their gospel, and it turned out that it was both effective and morally coherent. In fact, the fact that they set aside any recourse to violence sparked more creativity. It let aside the shortcuts and the dubious procedures and obliged them to be more creative and more committed in finding ways through the problems they were working at. They were activists making their concern effective, and not moralists trying to prove their relevance. I think that is a much more healthy way to deal with the story of nonviolent action, both the narrow focus of what we call nonviolent action, that is, organized campaigns to bring to bear certain kinds of pressure through specific tactics, and in the much broader sense, the awareness that everything healthy that we do in society is nonviolent. Any decent education is nonviolent. Any decent family life is nonviolent. So that we shouldn't limit the notion of nonviolence to specific tactics brought to bear on specific critical issues. And that means not focusing on the models of the late 60s. In fact, some of the nonviolent direct action of the late 60s was a little tired already, somewhat lacking in initiative. When black students in the South thought of the idea of sitting in restaurants, that was a creative idea, because restaurants are for sitting in. It fit the function of a restaurant to make an issue of sitting there until one is served or hauled off by the cops. When years later students would sit in the dean's office of a university, that wasn't the same creative response to a situation, because the dean's desk is not made for sitting in by students. The artistic appropriateness of the gesture in the context wasn't there. So people use marches for places, things where marching wasn't the fitting thing to do, or they sat in where sitting in wasn't the fitting thing to do. And there was, therefore, a certain waning of creativity and originality just at the time when these methods got popular. Actually, as I was saying before, everything political short of shooting is nonviolent. All community building is nonviolent. The particular forms of organized nonviolent tactics, like civil disobedience and the boycott, or being effective in sit-ins and marches, actually demand or only work within a democratic and pluralistic society. It wouldn't work in a completely totalitarian society. It wouldn't work, at least nearly in the same way. It works only to a very modest extent in Moscow these days, when the Jewish dissidents use that kind of techniques, because Moscow is partly open to the West. Otherwise, it might work much less than it does. So the discussion of how nonviolent action works is a very complex thing. I don't want to claim that it does always or well, but only that all of us are really committed to being nonviolent most of the time. And the question is how to search together what are the causes that can be dealt with by what kind of means. The commitment at the bottom is to the, not to the eschewing of certain kinds of weapons or to the shedding of blood. It's an affirmation of the dignity of the adversary. The point is not that if you avoid overtly shedding blood or breaking bones, you can somehow shame the other party into giving in, or you can somehow bring public opinion to bear on your side, and you'll win, and you'll really clobber them in the media. Now, that dimension is sometimes realistic, often unrealistic, but it isn't what's intended by the real thinkers of this kind of movement. The notion of nonviolence as simply a tactic, unconnected to a theology, was propagated in the 30s because one of the first Western interpreters of Gandhi was a man named Gregg, who titled a book War Without Violence. The idea being simply that I can get it for you wholesale. You can win a war without needing to pay nearly as much if you just use these tactics instead of those tactics. That's much too superficial, although there are elements analogous to a war. If you read Martin Luther King's story, you see that there are kind of strategy functions and timing functions and logistical functions and propaganda functions that are analogous in some ways to a military undertaking. But that's not the point. The difference is that the commitment is to the dignity of the adversary. The word violence itself has been defined and redefined and deepened and broadened and sharpened in so many different ways in recent times that that itself takes whole books. There are people who like to use the word violence for situations in which nobody takes a weapon to anybody, but people die, for instance, because of the lack of medical resources or malnutrition. That's a violent situation, they say. Well, that's one way to use the word. It just makes our language more confused to use more words in more different ways. We can do it if we have long enough to clear out our different definitions and have subscripts as violence sub one, violence sub two, depending on which thing you want to discuss. But it makes for some first level confusion to redefine the terms instead of trying to get at the substance. What was initially meant by the rejection of violence by those people who think you can live without violence. That is, that violence is something that you may choose to use or not to use, and you should choose not to, is the violation, violence is a verbal noun, the violating of the dignity of a person, or especially of a category of persons or a whole group of persons, if you're talking about institutions like war. But what is the measure of when violence has begun is the dignity of the other party. So nonviolence as a commitment is whatever action flows from a commitment not to violate the dignity of the adversary. That's my functional definition. The one I think has turned out to be most usable when we're debating how far to go or how much we can achieve this way or that way. Now, there is a quirk, if this is the case, to evaluating any nonviolent action in terms of what it can produce, because the action can never be separated from the goal. It's not simply a weapon. Now, you can use a gun on either side of a war. The same gun can be pointed in either direction. But nonviolent tactics are not a gun that can be pointed in either direction, because their validity depends on the moral claim being made for that which is being refused or that which is being defended. It can be simply said, it is simply said in the analysis, although it takes proof, you can only use nonviolence for a good cause, because part of its strength is a moral claim which it makes to the integrity of the other party. And if you are a mafia chief or a bandit, you can't really make that claim, and it can't really work. Now, you can extort by threatening violence if you're not going to use, if you're a mafia king, but that's something else. That may be an overstatement, but the point still remains that the meaning and effectiveness of nonviolent tactics is context dependent in such a way that you always have to ask what it is we want to save before you can ask whether it can be saved and how it might be saved. So much for introduction. That's only an introduction on this evening's subject. Now, as was said, we're open for conversation about other themes as well.
Are people prepared to settle in for a while? There's enough there to chew on for a few hours, I think.
While you're doing that, let me make an observation and try to raise a question for you, John. One of the things that we've observed is that so-called children's television is not harmless cartooning on Saturday morning, but really violates the dignity of the opponent. I don't remember all the names of all these shows anymore, but in one after another, the enemy is always total evil and must be destroyed. It's also subversive television, because the accused is never presumed innocent until proven guilty. Due process is denied. All of the constitutional protections that we have cultivated in the court systems and jurisprudence in this country are summarily swept aside. And to this, of course, children are entrusted for hours at a time on Saturday morning, so that they are not only not taught in so-called children's television programming the dignity of the enemy and the adversary, but the values in our judicial system are systematically and regularly and popularly undercut, so that our children grow up expecting black and white, for one thing, and violent solutions, immediate violent solutions, within half an hour, to most of the difficulties and problems that we confront. That's just by way of an observation that was triggered by what you said to me. But the question arises in a concrete historical case. How were the people who were who eventually were involved in the plot against Adolf Hitler, to make the decision that they did. Obviously, their attempt to assassinate Hitler did not succeed, and virtually all of them paid for that failure with their lives. Many of them, in a sense, dying in almost as martyrs, one could say. But the crux of the decision was that programs of the state were systematically destroying prisoners of war, civilian populations, and above all the Jewish population in all of these countries. And how does one respond in a situation like this? Bonhoeffer himself, a man of pacifist sentiments, finally consented to the assassination attempt, at least so far as we know. How would you respond to that kind of a concrete historical situation?
With a lot of time, preferably. It's the same time a very serious case, because it really happened. And the people involved were people of real dignity and willingness, obviously, to risk what they did risk and did pay. At the same time, it's very far from anything the rest of us are going to get in on. And one of the problems of being fair with this kind of subject matter is the usability of specimen cases that are not representative of the American military experience, but are only representative of trying to push the logic of a question to the nth degree in somebody else's situation. So I want to converse with the Bonhoeffer case for its own sake, but I have to insist that that isn't really America's problem. America and Britain did not enter the war to save the Jews. They entered the war for other reasons. They were not interested in saving Jews. They even turned Jews back that came to their shores. Therefore, the wars we fought in the past and the wars we're preparing to fight in the future have nothing to do with the Bonhoeffer case. It still ought to be looked at for its own case, for its own sake. And because ethicists always like to deal with crucial borderline samples, it is a fitting one. It is not as clear from the sources from then as it has been made since that the bulk of the resistance, or that any significant amount of the resistance movement to Hitler, represented by the network in which Bonhoeffer was involved, were driven, as he was, by concern for the Jews. He was very rare in his concern for the Jews. Most of the people were concerned for the dignity of Germany, and they still were. And they believed that if they could kill this one bad guy at the top that has sullied the dignity of Germany, we can clean the place up and make a gentlemanly Prussian pact with the British, who are, after all, our cousins, against the Russians. So we have to see the plot for what it was and not glorify it through the fact that Bonhoeffer became a martyr, or that he was one of the few people that saw the Jewish problem in Germany, when even Karl Barth said he didn't see it. Jewish dimension is really not part of the picture of what that plot was about. Larry Rasmussen, who's been here before, did his dissertation on this event, and it gets less clear as you get closer to the event who decided what and with what criteria. And for instance, if we say the logic of the just war calculations is objective logic, I didn't make that up to challenge the just war people, it's the just war logic it says, then whether it would succeed is always a question that had to be asked, and those efforts were practically doomed to failure. It wasn't simply that they almost worked and didn't quite, they were practically doomed to failure, and if they had killed Hitler, it isn't at all clear that it would have cleaned up. So the just war calculation of probable success is dubious in that case, and that means then, of course, that the halo of martyrdom, although one respects anybody who dies for something he believes in, even a Nazi, it doesn't prove much about the validity of the case that somebody's willing to die for it, if the reason for dying for it don't make sense. So that's a kind of a hard thing to say. We don't have to say on both sides of most questions. I was in a study group that visited East Berlin in 65, and we had a day with the man who was not then yet, but is now the Bishop of East Berlin, Albrecht Schoenherr, who was one of Bonhoeffer's students in the bootleg seminary at Finkenwald, and was quite critical of the way Bonhoeffer was being used, and the memory of Bonhoeffer was being used, both on this question and on the ongoing discussion of secularization and God is dead theology, making live in the world as if God weren't there. He felt that was all, both of those things were exploiting a noble memory in a way that wasn't quite fair. He thought that if Bonhoeffer still was living, he would be a pacifist, as Schoenherr was, and that he wouldn't make the case for the assassination. He was not, however, in the 30s, a pacifist of the discipleship type. He was an ecumenical optimist. He hadn't, his way of calling himself pacifist, as he did, was not theologically founded in the kind of ethical discussion we're talking about. So that I don't think he backed away from the kind of position that starts from the gospel in his pacifism. He deepened his social commitment, his willingness to suffer, by being ready to get involved in this plot. But it wasn't that he had held profoundly to a historically and biblically rooted pacifist position and then overcame it through deepening moral concern. The last set of questions that haven't been asked about the whole Bonhoeffer story is what it means if you are against a regime, that you continue publicly to support it. Because in order to have a cover to be in the resistance, he had to be doing a creditable job as a servant of the Hitler regime in an intelligence network. And that raises not only questions of killing, but questions of communication and truth-telling and many other things. To be a double agent, now which of the agent do you do ethics on? Or do you have to do ethics on both of them? And he was a double agent. And some of his friends in Switzerland, for instance, never were sure whether to trust him, because in order to be the resistant that he was, he also had to publicly support the whole Hitler regime. Now, when Russian Baptists do that, Karl McIntyre comes and says they're cheating, they're communists. How do we measure both sides of the ethics of somebody who plays two games? I haven't seen that done in the books that deal with Bonhoeffer. They deal only with the intent of the underground Bonhoeffer, and not at all with the product of the above ground Bonhoeffer. It seems to me you at least have to deal with both.
What price he pays for?
Yeah, not only what price, but maybe did he turn over people's names? Did he bring back important intelligence? Did he get some allied information that he turned over? I don't know. But at least he was enough of an above-ground servant of the Nazi regime to maintain their confidence so he could do his underground thing. I just say we have to deal with them both if we're going to do careful ethics.
To me, it has something to do with sacrifice. Does that strike making sense to anybody else? In order to, not just for him, but in the whole idea of nonviolence and determining for yourself what to do and what not to do, it's just not always easy. Sometimes it means making some sacrifices, even if it's a sacrifice of an ideal, of a good for a better good, or for a disturbing peace, or for a quieting peace, or a disturbing peace. I don't know how those questions can be dealt with so easily.
No, they can't be dealt with easily because they make for an ethics on more than one level, and that is very serious. I mean, it needs to be dealt with very seriously, but it's very complex. And Bonhoeffer made two kinds of sacrifices, and said so. One is obviously he risked his life and lost it. The other is, this is not as clear in his writings as it is in the writings of some interpreters later. And I'm not sure he believed it as clearly and simply as it's attributed to him, but there was the sacrifice of innocence. That is, the willingness to take upon oneself a kind of guilt for doing what one thinks at the same time is wrong, because it makes me guilty, and yet it's right, because it's the thing I should do. And that two-level ethics makes great complications in what we're talking about. A little of it came up this morning in the discussion of whether it might be said that to kill is never justifiable, but sometimes we've got to do it. That two-level ethical deliberation is very complicated, and we just have to spend a lot of time figuring out what we mean on both those levels.
Doesn't that same two-level ethics, as you call it, doesn't have to be on such a big deal? Just in decisions, I mean, what exactly we're going to do, whether it's a problem or just a decision.
It might be. I think it's just more visible when you have a big case.
It seems to me that that relates to the issue of integrity you raised in terms of nonviolence. Because to start off with the Hitler case, you may find it much more difficult to grant Hitler integrity as there must be several degrees of integrity that you are able to grant, and there of course comes in the exception to the killing, that it may not be good, but I have to do it if personally you're in a situation where you're defending yourself. And it seems to me that that relates to the whole just war issue in that way, whereas it seems to me there is no moral dilemma about an aggressive war, because that should be beyond consideration if you think you have an ethical base. The dilemma comes only in when you are in a position whether to wage a defensive war. I'm talking about not preventive defensive war, but when you're actually attacked, or whether to lie down. It seems to me that's the point where it becomes very difficult to grant integrity to your actual or potential or virtual murderer. And from there, I think we go to a number of other places in how we apply violence in various non-war-related situations.
I think you've made me see that integrity has several meanings. When I use the integrity of the adversary as what I don't want to violate, I didn't mean he's a good guy. Although some people on the other side are actually sincere, honest, God-fearing, wife-loving people. But I don't mean that Hitler was. So I didn't mean that to be a moral judgment on how good the other guy is. The real problem is that there is at least a sizable amount of intentional evil around in the world, and the question is whether we authorize ourselves to destroy those people. So I didn't mean to be saying that the major agents of the threat to which we need to respond violently or non-violently are always good, or that I want to give them the benefit of the doubt as to their good intentions.
You use the example of King and Gandhi for non-violent solutions, and they were successful, but it would seem to me that in King's case and in Gandhi's case, the choice really wasn't there, because I don't see that either of their movements would have been successful using violence. How do you relate whether their decision was one of morals or was one of practicality?
It's a correct observation, but I'm not sure that in order to be a moral decision, something has to be impractical. That is, I don't have to. The definition of the concepts don't make me make that choice between what's moral and what's practical. If the thing that's moral is not practical, I may still have to do it, but that doesn't disprove its morality when it does happen to be practical, and does happen to be the only practical thing. Now, I'm not sure that everybody thought in Gandhi's time in India that you couldn't get anywhere with the British with guns. I just don't know. I know that in King's time, in his later years, there were people that thought that you could get somewhere with guns in America. Some of the black Muslims, and Malcolm X for a while, and the Black Panthers in a couple more years, they turned out not to succeed, but maybe it was because they didn't try hard enough, or didn't do it well enough, or didn't go on long enough, or didn't have the right guns or something. So I don't deny at all your statement that in some cases, of which these are perhaps good samples, violent tactics didn't have much promise. I think that's true of most wars too. And most wars don't achieve the stated ends. Just look at the story. And so the fact that nonviolence is most usable where the ends are possible, well, that's true of war too. So I agree with the observation, but I don't know what flows from that for illuminating other debates. As I said at the outset, they were not pacifists trying to prove they were relevant. They were people trying to do what had to be done, and it turned out that nonviolent ways and setting apart any violence, limiting themselves to no violence rather than just a little violence, turned out to be the best thing to do.
Well, I was just cautioned that the two level of ethics can be very dangerous because it requires the whole notion of secrecy, and you can get caught up in one of the two levels and not really know who you are, whereas it seems to me a prime basis for a nonviolent strategy and way of functioning and thinking requires an element of trust. And there's really more or less a third option for both antagonists. And that it breaks that antagonism by allowing trust to be there. It isn't always a response because you know it's going to win, but it does trigger another option in people's mind. I think collectively, even though people might be killed up, it continues in some way. And it was just making me think that I think we are provoked nonviolently when we are put in an uncomfortable situation and have to speak out. That's when we are challenged in terms of how then we relate in that tension situation. And maybe we could bring this discussion closer to home in terms of how we, when threatened to respond to various situations, what would be our first thought or our first action? Would we just shut up? How would that relate to a notion of nonviolence?
It seems like in this country, a lot of violence that takes place now is sort of a revenge type of violence, and that gets back to talking about granting integrity to the violator. And that's really hard when it gets home. And I don't really know, you know, if it came down to a real personal thing. I haven't been raised in reacting to anything threatening violently. I've been raised to deal with things verbally, so I'm just at a loss when it comes to knowing how to use any of my faculties in a violent manner. But if I were to defend somebody that I care deeply about, or if somebody who's very close to me were being violated, my first instinct would want to probably to just crush that violator, because that's natural. And I don't know how that fits in with the very literal translation of you know, turning the other cheek or just allowing something to happen. But that in movies such as one that was put out a couple years ago called Death Wish, where I think a man's wife was raped, and so he took it upon himself to go out and avenge this violation of his wife. I didn't see it, so I don't know how the audience reacted to it, but I think audience reaction was gung-ho for this man who was out to, you know, do justice for somebody who he knew who had been violated.
Well, it's clear that our culture has taught us that there is an imperative to avenge, which is different from the imperative to defend. But we've merged them both, and they're both imperative. in our culture. That isn't only taught in the Sunday morning kids shows, although it's also there. It isn't really vengeance, but it's just always destroy the bad guy within the half hour. So certainly there are many elements of our culture. There are deep Semitic roots, and there are deep Teutonic roots, and there are deep Latin roots for vengeance. That's one of the basic mechanisms of the self-defense of any culture. So, and my question wouldn't be whether we're going to be literalist or not in turning the other cheek, but whether we think there's a point at all in what Jesus is talking about when he did not avenge himself, didn't even ask himself to be defended, told Peter not to defend him, and that he was taking another path. But it clearly is against what we have been taught and needs to be done. I would still insist on a big difference between vengeance, that is, after the fact, tracking somebody down to destroy him, when that destruction doesn't save anything of what he harmed, and prevention. And the question of defensive violence in the interest of a third party, that is an issue we haven't looked at, and which would have to be looked at. But it's different from vengeance, it's different from setting the world system right. It's much more disciplined if the case can be made at all. But if we just stop and think, even rationally, apart from Jesus, what is the good that is achieved by destroying, after the fact, someone who has destroyed someone dear to me? It does no good to the total social system, unless in the sense that teaching people that crime doesn't pay is what the system the most needs.
May do you some good, though, just briefly.
Getting off steam, the satisfaction of vengeance. There may be an emotional satisfaction for me in vengeance.
Chief Brew.
Well, in some cases, it also might prevent the evildoer from continuing.
Yeah, well, then it's prevention again, Rio. Yeah.
Of course, you never really know whether it is or not. Problem there.
Seems like one of the most horrible recent examples of retaliation was the retaliation of the Israelis on Lebanon after the raid.
Well, it's probably not. There's probably been a lot of worse things, but this one was done with such a good conscience and so much in the open, and so much in the name of things we thought we were friends with, that it was especially striking, certainly.
I'd like to ask a question which might help clarify one aspect of what you said, and that relates to your comment on the definitions of violence and how we use the term. You were suggesting that violence is the denial then of the dignity of the adversary. And in that sense, what is called structural or institutional violence would seem to hold. And yet you seem to want to speak of violence as an armed conflict. And maybe you could clarify that a little more. In that connection, then, if we can view violence on broader terms than simply armed conflict, isn't it just as difficult to determine the criteria for when we use or enact nonviolence as it is to determine criteria for a just war? For example, if simply as an American citizen I am committing violence against certain minorities in this country because of the clothes I buy made by certain companies who are prejudicial to their employees and so on, then how do I determine my degree of involvement or disinvolvement, my degree of nonviolence and violence there? Or is this then an understanding of the term violence and nonviolence and just simply too broad a term to be very meaningful?
I don't think it's too broad to be meaningful, but it's too broad to be manageable. That is, if everything means everything, then you just have trouble carrying on a quantitative discussion. And when the word violence is used to describe everything in the world that we don't like, and it's just more or less overt, more or less destructive, more or less immediate in how I hurt him, we've made our grasp of the thing so global that it has no handles. So it's just in the interest of getting the debate farther along that I look for smaller words rather than bigger ones.
But the unfortunate thing is that our participation in violence is much more endemic in those areas that do not involve armed conflict than it does in those that do.
Well, if that understanding of participation is something that you can handle, then I think we're talking the same game. Very often it's set up for things that we can't handle. Hmm. That is, there is no statement of what I should do differently if the United Fruit Company is abusing Guatemala. To say that it's evil, to say that violence is the word for that evil, does not yet deal with my ethics. I want to deal with my ethics. If there arises a structured response to the banana cartel that really makes my buying or not buying bananas a part of a meaningful strategy for change, well, then it becomes something that I can handle. But just to say there are these great big global things and we're all messed up in everything is opium for the masses. I mean, it just tells us we can't do anything. And that's dramatic, but it doesn't help ethics.
Sometimes also this takes our attention away from actual real violence that is on a smaller scale. I was thinking that if it involves the police pistol whipping suspects in a ghetto area, there's something you might be able to do a lot faster than you can do something about the United Fruit Company, for example, by reporting the police, as, you know, with a number of witnesses and so forth. I mean, you might be able to effect some change if you define violence, in fact, in those...
Well, I guess I didn't mean to suggest that our engagement in violence in this broad sense is necessarily political and particularly global in its dimension, maybe in fact in my own neighborhood, where such discrimination is going on that it really violates the dignity of my neighbors and yet does not involve pistol whipping or assassination.
No, I agree to the reading that must be dealt with and that we shouldn't avoid systemic issues and concentrate only on discrete acts of somebody hurting somebody. But I must plead that the concern for systemic issues must not be a cop-out for not dealing with the other, or even for saying that the issue is so broad that it's all the same. And I have to find the analysis that will lead me through into something that is ethically meaningful before I will have grant that this redefinition of the word usage has helped us. Now, the complexity is that very often in the liberation theology debates, the very same people who say we must insist that the price structure for coffee is violent because it keeps Brazilian working people from getting fair wages, also say that violence isn't always wrong. Well, if violence isn't always wrong, why is structural violence always wrong? Again, it's a kind of sophomoric playing with words instead of getting at the real ethical issue. Only if all violence is wrong does it make any sense to say that structural violence is also violence, and that the price of coffee is also structurally violent. If we have first affirmed on the grounds of the just war theory or any other structure for that some violence is justifiable, then presumably some structural violence is justifiable. And for the sake of the world economic order. So my concern here is not that I'm trying to argue strongly for the pacifist position. I'm trying to argue for cleanliness in language so that we can get a discussion going that will be on one subject.
John, I would find it helpful if you would talk a little bit about what you found to be valid or worthwhile or meaningful nonviolent acts during the Vietnam era.
I'll be glad to talk off the top of my head. I'm not sure how helpful it would really be, since the the context in which that happened was so internal to the American side of it, and the protest at the other side was mostly Buddhist, and their view of what constitutes the dignity of life was different, so that, for instance, burning themselves was a meaningful protest to a Buddhist. I'm not sure it would be for a Christian. But the kind of thing that I have to say most negatively is what I already said, that the choice of methods was not nearly as creative. They tried to use sit-ins and marches on subjects that weren't sit-inable or marchable. I think the big Washington presence after the Kent State killings and the organized moratorium march around Washington with the dramatic reminders of the number of American war dead were probably the most successful communication efforts, but they were aimed at the American public with a certain trust that if the American public just knew a little more of the truth, they would vote differently and that would solve the problem. That is, they trusted the normal political mechanisms for solving the problem once you get people informed. I think that was probably a mistake. More normal political mechanisms weren't working anymore. So that my picture of the Vietnam protest efforts were that they generally were a failure. It wasn't that that stopped the war. And maybe you had behind your question some hunches of your own.
No, I see what you're saying about what you think was not effective, but I was wondering what specific things, if there were specific things during that time that you felt to be important and valid to take part in.
Yesterday you gave an example, or not yesterday, last week you gave an example of a prison official who refused to carry out executions or to have the guards have armed weapons. Some of the things we're talking about fall into that area where Bartsch in an essay says, once a conflict was broken out, especially in an era of total war, there are only different ways of being guilty. There is no moral position left, because you are either helping your friends kill your enemies or helping your enemies kill your friends. And even in that situation, Bartsch is willing to opt for a better way for Christians to go, but not one in which one can claim moral justification. I would like to ask, not that you give some examples of what's going on in the conflict, but what potential is there now for us to bear a non-violent witness in a violent society, or in a society at least where significant portions of our national treasury are being used to support weapons. But because you are either helping your friends kill your enemies or helping your enemies kill your friends. And even in that situation, Bartsch is willing to opt for a better way for Christians to go, but not one in which one can claim moral justification. I would like to ask, not that you give some examples of what's going on in conflict, but what potential is there now for us to bear a non-violent witness in a violent society, or in a society at least where significant portions of our national treasury are being used to support weapons and potential violence.
Maybe I should try to say one more thing on Vietnam, though, before going on to that. One of the marks of one of the contributing factors to the adequacy of an action of protest or of non-cooperation or whatever you want to use the over small label for it, is the coinciding of several different kinds of abstinence. Is it, it helps if there is a point at which you actually say, I would be doing wrong if I did that thing. It helps if it's in a communication network where people will see it. It helps if it is kind of representative of bigger issues. And you can't make something representative of bigger issues and have the whole crowd see it if the initial symbol was arbitrary. So it helps if you have on all those levels the same kind of integrity. So that would mean that I would look in working against the Vietnam War at the point where there is an element of personal commitment. I cannot do that thing. At the same time that it has an element of visibility and of dramatic representativity, so that it speaks to people for something more than just itself. And I guess the thing that was really the most significant like that we heard about in numbers was draft refusal. That is when the man himself said, I won't go, whatever it costs, and then really sacrificed for that, either having to go underground or to China, to Sweden or Canada, or in some other way let it upset his whole life. The other kind of thing, but we can't write books on them because they're all over the place, would be a particular person in the management of the American presence in Saigon who would be decent instead of indecent, who would respect the rules with regard to prisoners of war. I met one man recently who had set up a special branch of the army, which was simply an effort to get medical care and orthopedic help and prostheses for people who had been crippled by the war, and moved into that branch of the State Department all the people with scruples about what they were doing somewhere else in the war. Pretty small thing to do, but it's probably pretty important for those particular people and as a witness. So those would be the kinds of things that where you combine a symbolic relevance and an actual, I can't do otherwise, ethical relevance for the person involved, that I would look for the cases and that I would have the most respect for. I'm not quite sure what to do with the Bartsch allusion, because again, it's a two-level ethics. That is, it's saying on one level we're all guilty, we have all sinned, and on the other level we still can make meaningful decisions. For me, the second level, where we still make meaningful decisions, is ethics, and the other wasn't ethics in the first place. It was theology or something. So I want to see the arguments on the second level, so the things to do, and forget about the question of whether our hands are clean or whether we're pure or whether we're all on the right side. That's irrelevant. What should we do? And I don't think Bartsch has clarified the discussion by making two levels out of it. Before a war is declared, we're still guilty. We're still always helping our friends kill our enemies or vice versa, if you use systemic thought at all. So I don't think that helps clarify. So maybe sometimes we have to muddy the water so we know what kind of dirt we want to filter out of. But I don't think it's really a helpful observation to say that at a certain point, all of a sudden, morality is out the window. No, it's just made more complicated at certain points, or less free at certain other points. The editor of Christian Century said the same thing. He was a pacifist until the war was declared, and then he said, there is no more any ethics, because war is hell. And that means nobody makes moral decisions in hell. It's too late. Now we're all involved. The conscientious objector who stays home and raises grain or stops forest fires is just as involved as the man who goes off to kill. I think there are two things wrong. One is that this makes it impossible to deal with the ethics you're still doing, because you claim to have finished ethics somehow. And the other is it ascribes to systemic involvement a degree of moral culpability that I don't think is rational, and would have made of Jesus his own murder, because actually he let it happen, and he told people to pay their taxes. So I don't think that degree of defining oneself as systemically guilty for everything that happened is true even in modern society. It would mean that all the Baptists are guilty for what the Russian communists are doing with the Jews, and I don't believe that. And this isn't a rational way to clarify real options. But now I would be grateful if the rest of you were agree with the Walt's suggestion that we work at our current agenda rather than at challenging the logic of extreme position. What would be things to do here and now? that would probably depend on spending some time picking up at which point we think the offenses of violence in our culture are the worst. Is it military budget and atomic preparation for the destruction of the world? Or is it the degeneration of urban life and the rising rich-poor gap? The failure to turn any real major corners with regard to minorities and the original Americans. Which of those intrinsically structured violences in our system are we most bothered about? And which are we most responsible for? Which are we most directly implicated in? Is it the military budget, or is that farther off than some of the other ones? There, I'm not asking a Socratic question for which I know the answer. We would have to work at that. And it might vary depending on who we are, or where we are, which of the elements of oppressiveness of our world we are most responsible to be concerned about.
Could I defend Marx a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, I want to, not directly, but if I were to ask you whether you're appealing to us as people of faith or as humanitarians and citizens, it might make a difference in understanding. That is, I think the church could, on the one hand, call people or make people completely free and therefore make their conscience more able to function, or they might call them to a kind of directly coupled obedience and say, now a good Christian is nonviolent. And I think the sort of approach we take would be opposite in either case. That is, whether we free people to act to decide an issue on prudential grounds, or whether we are promoting an ideal. And I'm not sure. You presented. I mean, you were willing to weigh the case for nonviolence on the grounds of success, or at least reject the claims of failure, which would seem to be prudential. Does that leave my question clear?
I hear three questions. I think they're all real questions, but I'm not sure which. I'm not sure that I trust them as questions. They're really in the discussion, but I'm not sure they help. One is the polarity between prudential and idealistic. One is the polarity between conscience and obedience. Those two are not the same, as far as I can tell, although you use them as if they were parallel. And the third is saying that has something to do with Barch, which is, again, something quite different.
I was seeing, may I say a word about Barch? I was just bridging on that, but I think it's a valid bridge in that I don't think he was being amoral, that is, like a person in hell saying it's too late for a moral decision. I think he's talking about a person being free for moral decision, not on the basis of ethics, but on judging each case, and still being conscientious.
Barch and I are old friends. I'm sure he doesn't mean that, but I grant your freedom to have that hypothesis.
I don't know.
No, he meant that you still do careful Christian casuistics about minimal violence, even after you're in a situation where you, as a West German, are on the side of the Americans who are on the side of the South Vietnamese. But you still try to be a pacifist, which means that you say the relatively less bad case is on the North, and you lean toward the North, but you still try not to be violent in your own commitment. So that's something very different from what you're suggesting, although your suggestion still is worthy of its own attention. The reason I said I don't know how much I trust those questions is that the polarity between prudence and idealism, I think, is a logically false polarity. saying, make prudential decisions is one kind of normative morality. To know what is prudent is to be measured only by certain goals, and no goal by which we measure prudence can itself be established by prudence. So I still have to know what the goals are, what the ideals are, by which prudential judgments will be measured. There's no such thing as pure pragmatism, it's only pragmatism with regard to certain goals. As to the polarity between conscience and obedience, I want to respect all my Lutheran friends, but I just can't see conscience and obedience as two poles, that if you're freer from one, you have more of the other. I can't see that as either psychology or Bible, that if you have less knowledge of what God wants you to do, you can somehow do it better. I respect the noble traditions in which that language is at home, but I can't follow it far enough to have a good debate. My understanding of conscience is that it's free because of a Lord, and that it gets freer from unworthy kinds of bondage by being bound more clearly to the Lord and by knowing more clearly who He is. And the idea that we would help people by telling them the Lord isn't the Lord after all, they should go by the seat of their pants, is not real help. I mean, that's not what you mean, but that's what I perceive traditionally in that kind of logic.
Excuse me for not calling a recess. I lost track of time, and then it seemed inconvenient. So perhaps we could just simply have another question or two, and then allow John to leave if he wishes to do so.
Earlier, I don't think that I can answer it really, but I was trying to grope towards it. You were asking if we could make an order of priority, mm-hmm. as to which of those various types of violence is more urgent to deal with. And I wonder if instead of putting them in order of priority, one might perceive a common root to all of them, which is in a competitive ethic, if you will. I mean, the urban problems you talked about, the whole matter of just war, I think, is based on that. Who is the better, and, you know, who gets closer to the truth, and who deserves more of this and more of that. And it relates to even to the kind of justice where we are where we're trying to take revenge for certain things. It all relates somehow to the traditional Western method of competitive operation. And how do we get at that? Is my question.
Well, that's the Holden Village Book of the Year. Mm-hmm. What is it about Western culture in which victory and dominance are themselves ultimately assured and mandatory? Where does that come from? It didn't come from Elijah, it didn't come from Jesus, it didn't come from Jeremiah. We can try to figure out some of its roots. I think it would be one fruitful thing to do to talk about roots in that sense. All of the various places where our culture has recourse to violence, from the Pentagon to the unemployed black young man who goes around looting, it's always because it's my duty to be somebody. And the notion that there might be another lifestyle than that would be an enormously liberating thing. And then we could ask just where we hit all of the interfaces with the structures of violence rather than which one is the most blatant.
Except that by broadening this, it surely helps in understanding, but does it help in terms of actually formulating strategies for nonviolent action to speak on it?
Not right away, maybe, but I suspect we would be more creative in formulating specific strategies if we really believed more deeply that there's good news. And if the good news involved not simply a better way to save face or to win a conflict, but a different way to seek God's will in a conflict, and a different confidence in what God's will in a conflict might be, and that suffering or defeat might not be so bad. If we're claiming to be the disciples of somebody who went that way.